Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, the road freight industry backing rail reform and calls for closer collaboration. Millions of litres of sewage leaking into South Africa's rivers daily. Africa's wealth grows faster than the world average. And cinemas are thriving as South Africans return to the big screen. It's Thursday, the 28th of August. Now, not surprisingly, the Road Freight Association has welcomed the announcement of South Africa's first private rail operators, describing the slot allocation process as a historic step in reforming the country's failing logistics network. With expectations that freight volumes could grow by 90 million tonnes over the next 5 years, the RFA says collaboration between road and rail is going to be key. So let's explore that in a little more detail. The acting chief executive is Kevin van der Merwe and joins me now. Kevin, a very warm welcome. You've described this as historic. Why is that?
Yes, for the first time, we are moving away from a situation where Transnet does all the movement of rail freight in South Africa. And as we are aware, it has been challenging. There's been a lack of funding for maintenance of the infrastructure. And as such, you know, for the first time, we sit with a situation where we've got privately owned train operating companies that are going to be given the opportunity to access parts of the rail and to move freight commercially, which brings in the element of competition. And obviously, competition could lead to a far better situation in terms of operations and effectiveness and efficiency.
All predicated, of course, on the notion that Transnet will honor all contracts fairly.
Well, there is always the doubt when one goes into a new situation that things may not be as they are appearing. Of course, the minister understands that they have to do something for Transnet to be able to increase its volumes. And a sensible way of doing that would be to get the private sector involved in it, bearing in mind that the cost of maintaining and improving the current infrastructure cannot just be borne by government. The resources aren't there anymore. And the injection that could potentially come from the private sector would go a long way to assisting with the covering of the expenditure required to do these necessary improvements and maintenance.
Kevin, given that your industry and your members have a vested interest in this whole process, I would imagine that you've been scoping timelines very carefully. And I wonder how quickly you think private operators can realistically start making a difference.
Well, if one looks at the intention is to have these train operating companies up and running by mid next year, I personally think that we've got a problem in that timeline, and I believe there are other role players out there that also believe it may not be realistic. But let's assume that everything goes well and that the contracts are put in place and the costs of access of the line, because I believe it won't be free, they expect to recover some costs from these private operators. So, you know, already if one considers the minister's objective to increase the amount of freight being moved on the rail, particular volume by 2030, already we're another year lost. And that puts that much more pressure on the 90 million ton increase the minister wants to see off a base of 160 million tons.
Contracts are one thing, and that's critical, as you rightly mentioned, but the regulatory framework has also got to be absolutely clear. Otherwise, huge risk exists.
Oh, absolutely. There's always going to be that. As you know, we're also relying on the economic regulation of transport to be fully implemented, and that will also have a great impact on the cost of access to the infrastructure. And, you know, until that's really up and running, it will delay the contracting process. I have no doubt that the minister will be trying to expedite everything possible to ensure that the regulatory framework is in place in good time to ensure that these TOCs, train operating companies, have the opportunity to put things in place. Of course, I would think that many of these train operating companies would still have to go and either lease or purchase rolling stock, as well as other equipment essential to being able to move freight from, you know, wherever it's loaded onto the rail system. So the time is essential, I would think. I'm hoping, and I think we all are, that the capacity to do these things quickly exists within Transnet, that intends leasing some of their equipment and rolling stock, I hope. That will also help to expedite matters.
And Kevin, the key issue I would imagine facing your organization is the collaboration between road and rail operators. Ideally, how should that be structured?
Well, I mean, at this point, there's a lot of freight movement taking place on road. You would have seen a tremendous increase, and the road freight industry has been lambasted, I think, quite unfairly because of the increase in the road freight volumes, necessarily carried by road due to failing infrastructure and the loss of capacity by Transnet. The bottom line is, you know, anything that moves on rail has to get to where it's loaded onto the train. So there will be a need to ensure that the role that is currently undertaken by some operators where they are involved in the long haul of product that should be on rail would still be there, but probably in a different form. And that is to, you know, take from the mine or manufacturing point to where the product gets loaded onto the train. And then, of course, on the other side, you don't often see the freight moving independently from the train. They have to go onto a vehicle again and be delivered to endpoint. So there has to be obviously a lot more work done, because it's not just a matter of the train operating companies contracting with Transnet. There will have to be contracts between the train operating companies and the actual road freight movers. So I can see there's a big role in terms of collaboration there.
And if all of this works optimally down the line, it will cut, surely, logistics costs for business, but not immediately.
No, not immediately. I can't see it. Look, there's a lot of freight that is ideal, you know, for transport by train. And that's generally your heavy product with low cost, and you want to keep that as cheap as possible and as efficient as possible. Obviously, congestion on the road being reduced is going to have a knock-on effect to road freight. It will make us more efficient. And of course, cost is not the only factor that is considered when moving product. It's about getting the product in one piece and all of it to the end destination, so that the person who's expecting to receive his product gets all of it in good time and at a good rate. So yes, we do foresee that there could be a reduction in the cost of freight delivered for the end user or the client. Yeah, I think there is that.
That's the Acting Chief Executive Officer of the Road Freight Association, Kevin van der Merwe. Kevin, thank you very much indeed.
Mind-blowing. Innovative and internationally acclaimed, Le Petit Chef is a gastronomic experience like no other. A unique, never-to-be-forgotten 3D and 4K tabletop projector dinner filled with fun, surprise and storytelling. Fancy a journey across the globe without ever leaving your seat. You could win two tickets worth nearly 4,000 Rand to experience the world's tiniest chef with the biggest culinary adventure. Enjoy 6 unforgettable courses inspired by Marco Polo's travels, from the fragrant spices of India to the icy peaks of the Himalayas, all paired with fine wine in a luxury setting at Blueberry Hill Hotel. Enter now at events@moneyweb.co.za and tell us about the official hashtag for the event. Your taste buds are ready for takeoff. Hashtag Dinnertime Stories SA.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, despite upgrades, South Africa's sewage infrastructure is failing to deliver, it would seem. Listen to this. Millions of litres of wastewater vanishing daily before they even reach treatment works. The groundwater, rivers and communities are obviously paying the price. So we need to ask, how did we get here and what specifically is being done? To discuss this crisis, I'm in conversation now with Dr. Mark Graham, aquatic ecologist and director of Ground Truth, also research associate at the Centre for Resources Research at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Mark, a very warm welcome, and maybe let's go to the very beginning here. How did your team first discover that so much sewage is going missing each day? What's happening?
Thanks, Jeremy. I suppose it started some time ago. Besides those introduction, thank you for that. I'm also a director of the Doozy Mgani Conservation Trust, which is an NGO here in KZN. And they've been monitoring rivers and community issues around water for the last 20-odd years. What really became evident in that observation work with the NGO was just the extent to which we had these failing sewer infrastructures around the province, particularly around Pietermaritzburg, where the NGO is focused. That led us into a sort of deeper dive into this space. And what we started looking at is that the government have a what they call the Green Drop Report, which is basically an assessment of the state of the condition of wastewater treatment works and how they're performing. So that was done in about 2013, and then there was a hiatus from 2013 till about 2021. The results coming out in 2013 were very uncomplimentary to the state of the sewage works, and at that stage, the assessment was stopped. The government then picked it up in 2021 and looked at it and said, let's relook at the state of sewage infrastructure. We got some of that data out of those reports, government reports, and when we started dipping into them, we discovered what was fascinating was that the inflow sewage works from 2013 and the volumes that were being measured then, compare those to 2021, were actually showing generally declines, which was congruent with what we were picking up in our NGO work, monitoring these river systems and getting reports back from communities for the watching sewers surcharging in their back gardens. So that effectively took us to this place and to investigate.
The primary causes of sewage loss would be obvious, I would imagine, everything from broken pipes to maintenance failure.
Absolutely. It's all of that, broken pipe, maintenance failure, but also, you know, the community understanding of how these systems get looked after, some of the failings around solid waste management. And if you're living wherever you're living and there's a sewer line next to you and if you're not getting solid waste removal, it's quite convenient to dispose of some of your waste in that system to keep your area nice and tidy. So, you know, it's got multifactorial kind of elements impacting on this. It's not just water. It's solid waste and management and education and understanding of these things as well.
I hope this doesn't sound like a stupid question, but what does this missing wastewater do once it leaks into the environment?
Well, that's the big insidious problem, really, is that this water lands up in the river systems. Typically, the water goes to the lowest point. Those are where the streams are, which then join, and we get multiple streams, we get rivers. These are the rivers feeding our catchment areas and going down to our drinking water supplies. And then the big problems start emerging. We've heard about Hartebeest Poort and all the alien weeds growing on there, but we start losing water. It's contaminated. It's more expensive to treat. It evaporates more quickly with alien weeds growing on it. And it's just a huge extra burden for society that we can, you know, ill afford.
And obviously this would pose huge health risks, particularly for more vulnerable and marginalized communities.
Absolutely. They're at risk from their health. You know, these are where the kids are playing, recreating, swimming in rivers unknowingly with this polluted sewage coming down. The Hammanskraal incident most recently is a case in point where the people are dying of cholera. largely because of these exact issues. But it's not only that, it's access to other biodiversity, the fish, the fisheries, marginal communities where protein supply would typically go and fish in these rivers. If the fish are not happy or not or polluted, impacted, they're also losing out at that level. So typically the lower marginalized side of our society are at most vulnerable and at risk from this whole lot.
And the tragedy here is it seems nothing has been learnt from that Hammanskraal incident in 2022.
We're slow learners. But, you know, some of the work that DACT are doing is, and in fact, I've just stepped out of a workshop now with the CWRR, with UKZN team, is how can we pivot to this? How can we involve broader aspects of society? How can we utilize the EnviroChamps model, which is a presidency-supported model through the Social Employment Fund, to actually get some of the unemployed youth involved in monitors, identifying, being able to identify where the issues are, engaging with the municipalities and actually trying to fix some of these things in an engaged way, but coming at it with citizen science, data support, and data-rich environments that actually not just, I think there's a problem here, but here's the actual problem. This is where the problem is, and what can we do about it? And engaging at a local level around these local issues.
Mark, beyond the important role that citizen science plays, and I do understand that, it's a bigger problem, though. We need better reforms. We need more investment, whether it's in infrastructure, governance, or accountability, to make sure that the gap is plugged, so to speak.
100%, Jeremy. It's all of those. What we're seeing is the more information we have that's supported by data, by science, by people who are involved, who live there, the greater the chance of that needle moving. Some of the work we did in Howick wastewater treatment work showed how that community monitoring the wastewater discharge into the river system when it was really bad and being discounted by the authorities, we could actually show the impact, and suddenly things started improving. So it's a civil society movement, but absolutely we need government to come to the party, municipalities, and we're just hoping with this effort and engagement with citizen science, we can actually have the data, have the integration, and have people informed of the issues.
Dr. Mark Graham, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, Africa's millionaire population is booming. The new Africa Wealth Report 2025 shows private wealth markets are expanding at a pace that outstrips the United States and Europe, and South Africa is still dominant. Mauritius is rising fast, and Cape Town is set to overtake Johannesburg as the continent's wealthiest city. That's by 2030. A lot of interesting data there. So let's discuss this with Andrew Amoyles, who's head of research at New World Wealth. Andrew, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with the big picture. Why is Africa outpacing the global average on wealth growth? What's the principal mover here?
I think there's a number of factors. I mean, particularly in South Africa, the last year and a half has been pretty strong in terms of the JSE, and also the rand has strengthened slightly. Some of the other big markets like Nigeria and Egypt haven't performed as well. But South Africa, Morocco, Mauritius, the Seychelles, they've performed pretty well over the last year in particular.
Why do you think Mauritius is proving so attractive to high net worth individuals and particularly South Africans? Not a day goes past when we read of somebody else who's relocated.
I think obviously taxes plays a part with Mauritius. It's obviously got very low income tax, no capital gains tax, which is always a big one for the ultra wealthy. Capital gains tends to be the main taxes that really wealthy people look at, because that's the main tax they would pay when they sell their businesses or sell their shares or sell their properties. So that, and also safety and security. I think particularly that area around Tamarin, the Black River area, has become a real hub for wealthy South Africans to go, and increasingly not just for retirement, also people that are actually working there. And so I think that, yeah, there's a number of factors. Obviously, it's got a very well-developed banking, financial services and wealth management industry now, which has definitely helped fuel the growth there as well.
So a good bullish outlook as far as the continent is concerned, but I would need to ask you how resilient this growth is given political instability that exists in so many countries.
Well, it's interesting because we obviously do the wealth migration report also with Henley and Partners. And one thing we picked up in our recent report, which I think I chatted to you a couple of months on, was that the UK and Europe are becoming less attractive among wealthy migrants. The US is still very popular, and obviously the UAE, UAE is rising, but also it's also there's some destinations in Africa that are rising, places like Morocco, places like Mauritius, the Seychelles. Also, there's a lot of increasingly a lot of people returning to South Africa. Obviously, they a lot of them are ex-South Africans, so whether you can count that as an inflow is debatable, but they are a lot of wealthy people that are moving to the Western Cape, particularly from the UK. So I think the instability and the problems in Europe and the UK could possibly benefit Africa, and I think that could be the secret going forward.
Let's get to the Western Cape in just a moment, but South Africa has continued dominance on the ranking despite its challenges. The difficulty, of course, is if those challenges continue to expand, it's going to be difficult for us to continue the growth that that is illustrated in these later set of numbers.
Yes, absolutely. That could be a could definitely be a factor. I think one of the things with South Africa is it does, as you say, it actually accounts for about 34% of Africa's millionaires, which is a significantly higher percentage than their percentage of GDP. So that, I think, tells a story in a way, possibly about whether the GDP figures for some of the other African countries are really accurate, but also just in terms of how many wealthy people live in South Africa and how well-established the luxury residential market is in South Africa compared to the rest of Africa. And I think that's definitely come across, particularly in this past report.
And is Cape Town really on track to surpass Johannesburg by 2030?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Johannesburg, the number of high net worth individuals in Johannesburg is up over 30% over the last decade. That's US dollar millionaires. And in Johannesburg, it's down about 30% over the last decade. So it's basically been a case of Cape Town doing really well and Johannesburg not doing well. Pretoria's performed slightly better than Johannesburg, down, but it's still down about 15%. But the areas that have really outperformed are actually the areas like the Cape Winelands, the Whale Coast, which includes Hermanus. They've actually performed the best with growth of about 40% plus over the last decade in terms of US dollar millionaires. So if you actually include the Cape Winelands and Cape Town together, they would already have surpassed Johannesburg. So it depends how you break it down. But we obviously, including Cape Town separately, that's why it hasn't yet overtaken Johannesburg.
And Andrew Amoyles, tell me this. Does your research look at which specific industries are driving Africa's wealth creation story?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, financial and professional services is still by far the biggest industry that's driving growth. But increasingly, fintech is becoming a much bigger one. Software development also is coming into play, but particularly ecotourism is another one. But the big one is really financial and professional services, which obviously includes all the banks, the wealth managers, the law firms, etc.
And on the downside, sharp contractions in millionaire numbers in Nigeria and Angola. Is there a common thread there?
Well, they've had massive depreciations of their currencies against the USD over the last decade. So our numbers are obviously in US dollar terms. So that's negatively impacted on them. Also, Nigeria has suffered from a large exodus of wealthy people, particularly to places like Dubai. A large number of wealthy people have left there and moved to Dubai and Europe. So that's negatively impacted on their growth. And that's why they've got such, I think the number of high net worths is down over 40% there over the last decade, which is obviously quite poor.
And Andrew, Africa's mobility gap, I'm talking about things like visa and travel restrictions, that would surely negatively impact wealth flow.
Yes, I mean, that's always been one of the things that has held South Africa and Africa back is the lack of mobility. So if you're a passport holder in Africa and you don't have a passport for another country, then it's often quite difficult to travel without having to get additional visas and line up and go through all the admin. Even in South America, which you could say is on a similar sort of economic par to South Africa, they have much better visa mobility than South Africa. They can visit about 170 countries visa-free, whereas in South Africa, you can only visit about 100.
And just a final one, we see the rise in millionaires. It's a good story for the continent of Africa, but what does it mean for broader society? It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to translate into more inclusive growth, does it?
Well, I think one thing we've always found is when the number of high net worths go up, the middle class tends to go up by a very similar percentage, often within 5%. So if the high net worths go up by 50%, then the middle class should go up by between 45 and 55%. So that's what we've always found when we've looked into the middle class. So there is definitely a link, obviously, because of the things that drive high net worth growth, such as the stock market, property prices. They obviously impact on the middle class as well. Also, high net worth start businesses that obviously boost the middle class. So it definitely has an effect, a big spillover effect. And even on a very high level, like the billionaires, because most of the really big businesses in Africa are owned by billionaires and centimillionaires. So growth in those segments, although there aren't that many of them, there's only about 350 centimillionaires and 25 billionaires in Africa. If you were to take those people away, it would have quite a big negative impact on the middle class, because all those businesses, they hire and pay a lot of people that are middle class.
Andrew Amoyles, thank you very much indeed. He's the head of research at New World Wealth. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move on to media now. And in an age of streaming, short-form video and endless tiny screens, the big screen, I read, still holds a powerful place in the lives of the South African consumer. Brandmap's latest survey shows that movies rank third among favorite pastimes, with nearly 9 million adults going to the cinema and millions of them regular or even fanatical about the experience. Despite the cost of living crisis, moviegoing appears resilient. It's fueled by loyalty deals, partnerships, and that irreplaceable magic, I guess, of the cinema experience. Well, let's wade into this. Let's lift the curtain, so to speak. Brandon de Kock is with me, Director of Storytelling at Brandmap. It's an interesting one, Brandon, and welcome to you. Why do movies still rank so high among our list of favorite pastimes?
Hi there, Jeremy. Thanks for having me again. Yeah, this is an interesting one. I think it's very much an example of that IRL thing, you know, the in real life that we all forget. I think as humans, we're so obsessed with the digital world that we forget that there really is something quite cerebral about the old way of doing things. And cinema is definitely one of those things. When you think about it, it's a fairly unique experience. You know, it's just not like sitting at home and watching something or watching something on your cell phone. It has an experience about it. It's probably a poor analogy, but I mean, it's a little bit like going and watching a live music concert as opposed to sitting at home and listening on your hi-fi. So I think there's definitely that aspect to it. There is a bit of magic still about the movies. Mm.
I agree with you that it is a unique experience, but you'll agree with me that it can be an expensive one, particularly if a family is going.
Sure, and I think that's kind of the big obstacle. But it has been, remember, this is not a new issue. I remember, when the blockbusters of the world first opened up, you know, there was that huge thought in everyone's head, what are the movies going to do? You know, are they going to halve their prices in order to fill the cinema, or are they going to double their prices in order to make up the loss? And I think if you go all the way back, you'll probably find that it was more like the latter. You know, there's no doubt that cinema increased its prices to try and make up the shortfall, and they're still there. So it is a spoil. There's no doubt about that. I think there are very few people who can afford to go to the movies as regularly as we used to, maybe, you know, 25 years ago. So yes, it's a bit of a luxury. It's still a reasonably affordable luxury. You know, I mean, and I do like this new vibe that some of the guys are doing, where they're bringing back the old classic movies for sort of 50, 60 rand a ticket. You know, there were some very good movies made over the years, and it's quite nice to go and watch some of them again in the big... I actually watched E.T. at Kirstenbosch Gardens a couple of years ago, and it was a fabulous and slightly bizarre experience, but it was great.
I'm glad. I'm glad you used. It was a good movie. I'm glad, Brandon, you used the word blockbusters. 9 million people going to the cinema. That's a lot of people. Yeah. Is it the blockbuster? Is it the type of content that brings it back, or is it something more than that?
Well, I think if you look at just the box office figures, yes, I mean, obviously the big movies, you know, the kind of the F1s and the DC Comics movies and these kind of things are probably still in the like 20 million take range. But, you know, a really good local movie is still somewhere in the sort of 8 to 10 million rand box office takings range. So, you know, there's, yes, I think is the answer to your question. I mean, the big international movies are obviously what it's all about. But there is still, there's an enormous amount of local content going down at the moment. There's some fabulous filmmaking happening in Africa and South Africa in particular. And there is definitely support. But I guess the issue just is how many people are likely to go and watch, you know, more than one movie a month, let's put it that way. And the answer to that is of the 9 million, there are probably only about 2.5 million people in South Africa in the consumer class who are monthly moviegoers. So I think they're probably quite picky about what they go and watch.
So, Brandon, you talk about E.T. I'm very excited. Tomorrow night on Netflix, the Thursday Murder Club drops, and I can't wait. But serious question, streaming is, whether it's in the short or medium term, is threatening cinema, or do consumers see them as complementary?
So I think that there's the evidence would be that that movies are the driving force, right? It's the fact that they play such a massive part in our lives. You know, when you said earlier, you started by saying it's the third biggest thing people are interested in. I mean, that's third only to music and travel. You know, it is a massive piece of life for people is watching movies. And I think that all that's happened is same as any other medium. You know, the menu has just widened. So I don't know if this resonates with you, but I mean, I certainly won't go and watch something at the cinema that I think I can watch just as happily on Netflix when it comes out. You know what I mean? If it's a drama or something. Mm. But the moment it's a big screen experience, you know, the moment
it's got to be an occasion. Yeah.
You know, if Tom Cruise is flying around in an airplane, it's not a great experience on my iPhone. You know,
yeah.
it's a great experience. Then I'm willing to actually pay the money. And I think that's why those DC Comics and the Marvel Comics kind of movies obviously have such allure. They obviously are very different on the big screen. So it's horses for courses stuff. But I guess the what we were trying to show with this story is just that it's not one of those, it's an old traditional medium and it's dying. It's just found a different place and a different level. But you know, people are still definitely going to the movies.
It's found a different place and a different level, but there's also a new operating model. And I'm thinking about loyalty programs and discount deals. And that would have an impact on attendance, no doubt.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we see the footprint of something like Steer Kinnikor's program. It's about 12% of the loyalty share. So 12% of people who use loyalty are members of Steer Kinnikor Club. And those kind of platforms, that loyalty idea definitely works in cinema's favor, you know. Once you're part of the platforms, you start getting really good deals once off. You know, you can, for the price of a normal ticket, you can chuck in a Coke and a popcorn as well kind of thing. And I think it's a big play for them. If I was in the movie business, I'd certainly be squeezing and leveraging that loyalty mechanism as hard as I could. So yeah, and again, there are good deals to be had out of that, you know. And we're all getting better at using loyalty programs and understanding them. And I think it's a good way to go and see more movies is to join up with one of these.
So what does the data say about younger audiences? Are they still loyal to the big screen, or is it just people like you and me who go and watch E.T. at Kirstenbosch?
So funny enough, younger people are actually more likely to be what we call a fanatic, or we call a cinema goer. People who are going, you know, like six times a year or more, so once every 2 months. And the group most likely to do that are actually 25 to 35 year olds. So, you know, and the second most likely group are the under 25s. Mm. So I think that plays back into that in real life thing. You know, there's for younger consumers, you know, we speak down a lot of the times about the younger generations and their appreciation of life and the world and in real terms. I think there's a massive desire on their part to engage with the real world, to be part of something, to sit in a controllable crowd and, you know, enjoy an experience together. go with your mates. You know, it's a very different experience, and it definitely appeals to young people. Yeah, so we don't see that. If anything, older people are less likely to be going to the movies as often.
Brandon de Kock, thank you very much indeed, Director of Storytelling at Brandmap. And that is where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.